Welcome to Tour Guide Tell All, your friendly neighborhood tour guides with their little historical podcast. That's us here to tell you about some of the lesser known hidden gems in Washington, D.C. So this is one of our many episodes where we dig into a memorial, a statue, a hidden site. And we've got a really good one for this episode. I think it's a memorial that a ton of people have seen, people walk by all the time. And I don't think people appreciate how insane the story is behind this memorial. I think it truly has one of the most interesting origin stories of any memorial in D.C.
And I'm Dan. I don't usually hop on to the podcast anymore. I should probably introduce myself, yes. But you've probably heard my voice at the end of our podcast because I've been doing a lot of the editing. But this is also one of my favorite memorials, both in terms of the sculpture itself is gorgeous and beautiful and one of the most dramatic sculptures, very much on par with antiquity, like the highest part of sculpture in our entire human history. It's just a gorgeous sculpture. And then, as Becca was saying, the origin story behind it is crazy. And chances are, if you have taken an eighth grade field trip to Washington, D.C., it is very possible that you know this statue because about 90% of all official class photos will take place in front of this memorial just behind it because it is on the west side of the Capitol. So you get up on near the balustrades that's part of this memorial, and it is just beautiful, and it's a great shot of the Capitol. So that's why a lot of people like to stand up there. Not because of the sculpture, but because it's a great shot of the Capitol. And then they look around and they see this glorious sculpture and they want to know more. So that's what we're here to do today.
So I had to bring Dan in because Dan, listeners, you may not realize, has a glorious beard, just like the man who is honored in this memorial today, the one, the only Ulysses S. Grant. We're talking about the Grant Memorial on the west side of the United States Capitol. And it's sort of a no-brainer to me that we would have a statue to Ulysses S. Grant, that we'd have a memorial. This is the man who leads us to victory in the Civil War, the Union side. I love how he sort of bookended with Lincoln on the far end of the National Mall, gazing at Grant, and Grant 2 miles away, gazing back. I love that little bit of symmetry. And he goes on to be an exceptionally popular and well-regarded political figure. Despite maybe some of the scandal of his administration, he seems to sort of be able to rise above it. Incredibly well-regarded in the 19th century.
I was going to say, in his time, because I think, especially when we were growing up and the high school version of history that I got was Grant was a great general and then he became president and wasn't really interested in being president and he let all these corrupt people be corrupt and he sort of sucks. But I think he's getting a revival as historians have dug more into his story. And of course, the newish Chernow biography is sort of rehabilitating his standard or grandeur to what it was at the end of the 19th century.
Yeah, I think the last 20 years have been very good for Grant in terms of historians really looking back, because I think he was very well regarded in his time. Immediately after his death, he has this really kind of solid legacy. And then the generation that served under him passes on. And most of the 20th century, we have this caricature of Grant. And it's sort of a shame because he's really so interesting. And I'm glad to see there was the not that long ago History Channel did that 3-night series that really dug into Grant. And I had a lot of people watching it who were like, I had no idea that he didn't just win the Civil War out of dumb luck. He was actually knew what he was doing. And he's such a man to me of contrast. I find it so interesting. Like, he's a military guy who can't stand the sight of blood. Going to war makes him queasy. He doesn't care about glory. He doesn't care about if anyone's going to write books about him. He doesn't go into battle with a velvet overcoat or an immaculate uniform. He's just as happy to be in his everyday overcoat and hat. So he's sort of this really unassuming figure, especially as a Civil War general. And the memorial does that. It captures that. Instead of glamorizing him and putting him in this really pristine Union's uniform, he's sort of like, you might not even know he's a military figure. If it weren't for all the other things surrounding it, you'd just be like, that's a guy in an overcoat on a horse. And it's hard to know it's Grant unless you know it's Grant.
Yeah, it is. It's on, what is the pedestal, like 17 feet tall. So even when you're right at the statue itself, it's far away from
his
you.
Face is about 40 feet yeah. above you, all things said and done, if you're on the ground. So it's really hard to kind of figure out who that is.
And I think it also, when you compare it to probably the other most famous equestrian statue in Washington, D.C., at least, that being the Andrew Jackson statue, how dramatic that is. And what I love about the statue, and sort of the exact same point you were making, is the statue of Grant is very stoic, very solid, very rough and not glorified and not on, you know, charging off into battle or anything like that. But then all the drama is in the two sculptures that flank the statue, or to the left and to the right of the statue, that are on eye level, that you could get right up close and see. And one of them, I know, I think in our outline we put the description afterwards, but I'm going to talk about it a little bit.
That's okay. I think we should paint a picture.
Yeah, paint a picture. So painting a picture, if you haven't seen this, if you're not looking it up right now.
And we'll link to it in the show notes, we promise.
And we'll try to get a few good pictures of what we probably both think is the most interesting fact about this statue, but we'll talk about that in a second. But the main statue is on this tall, tall pedestal. It's an equestrian statue of Grant, and very large. I think it's the second largest equestrian statue.
I think at the time it was cast, it was one of the largest bronze sculpture sets ever done.
Yes, very much so. And because it is commissioned in 1902, so they know the scale, they know what they're going to do. It will take about 20 years to finish the darn thing. But yes, especially at the beginning of the 20th century, this is going to be a huge, huge sculpture. But those side pieces, one is of a cavalry charge, and it is the most, again, dramatic cavalry charge you will see in sculpture form, maybe even in cinema form, even in moving pictures, because it looks like it is coming right at you. And then there's an artillery grouping sculpture on the other side of it. So I love that juxtaposition of this very stoic, very serene Grant's just sort of literally above it all.
He looks so calm and in control. And you think of the chaos of the Civil War, you think of what these battles were like. And this is sort of how people who remember him on the battlefield said he was like. He could just keep that calm and just survey what was happening. And it's so beautifully captured in the memorial. So I guess we should go back, though, a little bit and talk about how this memorial came to be. So Grant dies in 1885, and he literally finishes his memoirs, which is going to be the only source of income for his poor widow, Julia Grant. But he publishes memoirs, and like 3-4 days later, he dies. And so President dies in 1885. At this point, too, we're 20 years out from the Civil War. Civil War remembrance is really starting to pick up as this generation starts to pass. And so not too long after Grant's death, there's already a movement from the Army of Tennessee to honor Grant, to put a memorial to Grant. And Congress is like, yeah, this memorial is a good idea. We should have a memorial to Grant. We want to have some Civil War statues on the west side. This is perfect. And so they do what Congress does, and they do a little design contest. And they set aside some money, and they're like, okay, we're going to put out this design contest. And they get 23 artists who submit 27 different designs. And there's some pretty big names competing. There's a guy named Charles Niehaus who puts in, and everybody thinks he's going to get it, because at that point, he was the sculptor in Washington, D.C. Even today, if you go to the United States Capitol and you look at the statuary collection of the 100 statues, 6 of them were done by Niehaus. It used to be 8, but a couple have moved out since. And he still holds the record for having the most for a single artist in the statuary collection. So everyone thinks it's going to be him. And then there's a surprise. There's a dark horse contender who wins this design contest, a man named Henry Murren Schrady. And he's got an insane backstory.
So beginning with his father, and I didn't actually know anything about his father before I sort of did a deep dive for this one, but his father was actually very famous for his time. His father's George Frederick Schrady. And this is going back to early 1800s. I think he's born in 1830. Both of his grandfathers had been in the Revolutionary War. George Frederick Schrady becomes a very prominent physician. And that's where the interesting connections to this memorial pop up. He is the main physician. He specialized in the throats, and that's what Grant was dying from, his throat cancer. So he is called in, he becomes tending physician, and he writes basically, I couldn't find the exact format, but he was basically publishing status updates on Grant's health. And so the nation, before Twitter, before Facebook, was just sort of riveted to these posts. So he becomes not just nationally known, but internationally known. In fact, Emperor Frederick, who was also going to be suffering from throat cancer, he will be invited to attend to him as well. So that's one interesting connection. And a lot of people say that that possibly was one of the reasons why his son, Henry Schrady, got elevated, because of that close personal connection to Grant himself. So that's kind of fascinating to me. And then also the location of the memorial is very close to where President Garfield is shot. And Dr. Schrady was actually called in to help with that. He wasn't the main physician. I know we talked about Garfield on another one of our mini episodes.
If you haven't listened to our Garfield and Gatow episode, you'll definitely need to, because it's got a nice overlap, I think, to this. It's a sign of how respected he is, though, that he's called in to attend to a president.
And a cool little connection I found to one of our other tours. I'm just going to throw this out there because we are tour guide tell-all. He is also, Dr. Schrady's at the first electric chair execution.
I love it. I love it so much, guys. We're going to do a podcast about the first electric chair execution.
Which will actually, that'll be really great because Tesla, that weird movie Tesla is coming out. And that's part of it, the electric current wars between them. But anyway, all these fascinating connections to our tours. So that was mostly for me and Becca. Apologies. But hopefully you find it interesting too. So his father, who by the way was born on a farm in what is now Central Park, which I just think is great too. And what's fascinating about that is as a doctor during the Civil War, that's where he attended to patients, the field hospitals that were set up in that area. So he comes from this really interesting family. He's obviously a man of privilege. He will go to Columbia University. He will graduate undergraduate school. He will go to law school. And as many people who go to law school soon figure out after their first year, nah, not for me. And then he will go on to business. That business fails. And at the same time the business fails, he contracts typhoid. And this is one of those things that the glass is half empty, half full. But this is what gives him the time to actually pursue these interests in art. He's laid up, he's recovering from typhoid, and he needs something to do. So his father had actually been a pretty good amateur artist. And so that was in the family. And that's really when he starts sculpting and really gets involved in this art world. And that's what will eventually lead to him getting this commission, which he does at a fairly young age, 1902.
He's 31, yeah.
He's 31. And later on, towards the end of his life, which is around the end of this time of the sculpture, he will say that he was just a kid when he got this. And he spends almost half his life working on this sculpture.
I have to do my little women's history bit here. If
please
you listen,
do.
You know, one of the things I love about Schrady's story is for him, art is sort of a hobby. He's a man of privilege. He's recovering. He's doing this art for him and this idea that maybe it would make a little bit of money here or there. But it's his wife actually taking a bunch of his paintings and drawings without his knowledge, submitting them to the National Academy of Design. And that's what really elevates him. So all of a sudden, he's getting commissions, he's getting more interest, people are saying, what other else can you do? So I wonder if she had never sent that, if he would have ever been kind of in this place to put in this major design contest for this major memorial. Because up to that point, he'd been sort of working just within his little circle of people who knew him and his father. But his wife was like, I think you're pretty good. Let me send this off to the best artists of our day. And that's what she did, which I just find really interesting. Not to say he's not motivated or ambitious, but that it kicks him into a new level of his career that maybe he wasn't expecting. And then this comes along. And it's huge, a commission to do a memorial to a president. This is big money. Congress has allocated considerable funds, I think something like $750,000 at the time, like a pretty good chunk of change. And they give him a deadline, a laughable deadline of 5 years, which is insane when you think about what they want. They want this massive memorial. They approve a very ambitious design. And then they're like, okay, 5 years, which of course he's going to get extended 10 different times. And I find this image of him very endearing of like, just as he gets older, right? And he's going through his 30s and his 40s. And he's just like, please, I didn't know what I was doing. I need more time. And the level of attention he puts into this is insane to me. It's like, okay, I'm going to sculpt some horses. So what does he do? He goes to the New York Police Department and says, I want to see your best mounted horse. You've got policemen on horseback. I want to watch the best ones. He goes to veterinarians and he's like, when you have a horse die, can I autopsy it so I can understand the biology of it better? He's like, I need to see what artillery drills look like. So he goes to West Point and he watches West Point cadets drill. He researches Civil War uniforms and weapons and everything he can, anything he can find on Grant's death mask, so he can really get the face right. It's an insane amount of detail and work he does.
think he even joins the New York National Guard for a bit to actually not just like witness. He does go to West Point to witness these artillery moves, but he says that's not enough. I need to actually be on the ground. I need to participate in these so that he really understood what he was looking at and trying to sculpt. And then the other crazy thing, he does go to the veterinarians. He also enrolls in biology classes at the Natural History Museum and really gets into how to define the musculature of these animals to really, really get it right. It's crazy.
And I think a little bit to his detriment, he's so insistent on getting it right that for the cavalry charge, that lead horse, he did it 9 times before he was happy with it. And when you see the size of something like that and you go 9 times, no wonder it took him 20 years. He just became obsessed to the point that he's working and working and working and working. And it starts to really take a toll on him physically and mentally.
I think he is in the hospital, I forgot how many times, but at least I think like 3 or 4
multiple
times.
Hospital stays.
One surgical procedure, which I couldn't find much more information on, but everyone who worked with him saw what was happening to him, could see the physical degradation, the mental degradation as he is pouring literally his life into this. And when you do get to go see it, if you get to go see it, you can feel that, especially in those sculptures that are at the ground level that you can walk up to and touch and almost crawl into and see that drama and see the musculature on these horses.
And when you realize, when you're up close and you realize that every face is unique, every horse is different. He wasn't just taking something as was common in this era and sort of having 3 figures and just replicating. Everyone is unique. And I find that fascinating, but also sort of like, dude, what are you doing? You don't have to work this hard. Nobody's gonna notice. You could probably have like chilled out a little bit. And then of course it's put together kind of in pieces over time. So elements of the memorial start arriving in 1912, and then you realize it's still not gonna be dedicated for like another 10 years, which is just...
And the final piece will be the Grant statue. So they do the cavalry charge first and then artillery. And then finally that last piece is delivered. And I think when it's dedicated, it's still not even officially done. I think they still had to do a little bit of work on it.
They did the dedication to time with what would have been Grant's 100th birthday, which I guess at that point they're like, it's been 20 years. It's Grant's 100th. We've got to do this. Like this needs to be done. It is sort of amazing. It is the same year that the Lincoln Memorial is dedicated, which I don't know if I've always put together in my mind that they're dedicated in the same year, which really is a little nice little bookend.
Yeah. And I don't think I sort of knew that, but didn't put two and two together.
Yeah.
And especially because they weren't developed in concert with each other. They were totally separate projects. They
Not
seem
at all.
Like they're perfect bookends to the National Mall today. But those are very different, very separate projects. You mentioned the faces. Do we want to talk about the face?
We definitely should. The face.
The face. Do you want to do it?
So, you know, it is, as Dan said before, the drama of this memorial is one of my favorite things about it. And it really begs you to kind of look closer. And as you're looking at this memorial and you're looking over at the artillery, am I right that it's on the artillery side or the...
It's on the cavalry. Sorry. Chart,
on the technically horses on both sides, guys. So
yeah,
this is where I get confused. Over on the cavalry charge, you have this very chaotic scene because if you have witnessed what these cavalry battles were like, things could get crazy. Riders get thrown, horses get shot, horses get scared. And so you have this cavalry charge and you have this rider that's been thrown from his horse and you see his face and behind him is about to be the stampede that is surely going to crush him to death. And you look at this man's face and you can see the worry and the pain and the fear. And then you're looking and you're like, wow, this is so powerful. And then if you look into this memorial, you realize that is the face of the sculptor, Henry Schrady. He put himself in his work, which was not uncommon. Sculptors did that all the time. But he has himself as the man about to be trampled to death.
Which So much psychoanalysis could go into that, especially for someone who does die 2 weeks before the dedication of this final thing. And that part of the memorial was the first part that was done. That was one of the first pieces that was delivered.
So you could sort of see where he felt halfway through this project. This is killing me. This onslaught that I cannot stay ahead of.
And putting those two things together, the terror of the writer about to get trampled and the terror of the sculptor putting himself into this, it's just mind-blowing. And you feel, I think it's one of the statues that I really, you have this sense of connection and empathy because of the drama of the whole scene to begin with. And then once you understand that that is his face and all the heartbreak and all the trouble that he went through to get this perfectly right, it really hits you right in the face. Yeah,
it's incredible. And then to add insult to injury, they added a little plaque to the memorial to honor the people who had modeled and been part of this. And his name is included, and his middle name is misspelled. His middle name is Merwin, and it says Marvin. So it says Henry Marvin Schrady listed. I mean, the disrespect there.
No respect, as Rodney Dangerfield would say.
You can't make that up. And no. I don't know, up to the point of a few months ago, it had not been changed. They have been finishing restoration to this memorial, very long overdue restoration, to fix things that had broken off, to replace the 8 lampposts that had been vanished years and years ago, bring the patina and all that back to life. So there's been a long going restoration effort to this entire memorial, which has been needed. But I don't, to the best of my knowledge, believe that they were going to change that and update it. So it's sort of upsetting to me a little bit. But it also makes me laugh.
Yeah, it seems like one thing they could fix. Yeah, if you came here in your 8th grade field trip and you are not still in high school, then chances are you saw the version of the statue that was very heavily with the green patina, sort of the aging oxidation of the original bronze. So they stripped all that, and now it's back to the original sort of brownish bronze color. So it looks beautiful. I mean, it was sort of cool with the green patina as well, but this is what it looked like.
The restoration work has made it particularly, I think, you know, it enhances the drama. But then when you look up at Grant now, that 10,000 pound bronze statue of Grant on Cincinnatus, his beloved horse in the Civil War, with the new patina and stuff, it really just, I think, makes it easier to appreciate it. You can see it a little better and I think appreciate that look he's giving, that above it all, like, we're going to get through this. We're on the right side of history and this war is terrible, but we are going to win. And he just sort of has this unrelenting stare forward.
And I will say that I have tuned into that as a tour guide, because setting up the kids to do that picture can be a nightmare. And sometimes you just need to step back and you need to look up at Grant's and the serenity that is Grant's and take a deep breath and say, if that man can win the Civil War, I can get these kids into a line by height. So that is my personal connection to that serenity of Grant there. Yeah.
One of the things I think makes Schrady interesting is that, you know, because he gets into art a little bit later in his career, he's already tried to be a lawyer and a businessman, and then he spends 20 years of his life working on this. There's not a ton of other work that Schrady's done. There's a few things. There's George Washington at Valley Forge, which is in Brooklyn today. So if you have seen that Washington, a little, again, kind of downtrodden, he's into the downtrodden look. If you've seen that statue in Brooklyn, that's Schrady. But there's another one that I did not realize until recently Schrady had done, and actually he doesn't finish it because he dies before it can be completed. But it's an interesting, I think, parallel to the Grant Memorial, and it's the memorial of Robert E. Lee in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Yeah, and that is a very controversial memorial.
I believe it is still there currently. I don't think it has been removed from Charlottesville as of yet. And, you know, they shrouded it for a while, but that was the proposed removal announcement was part of what had sparked that the huge rallies and then counter protests and all of that. So it's amazing to me that this one sculptor does these two men who face off, does Grant, does Lee, And that even though he dies before the Lee statue is completed, that that's really Schrady's sort of last thing, is this controversial, very much a spark point memorial. Yeah.
Well, today, and we were talking about this before we got on to record, but I mean, I find that period of history to be so fascinating, that early 20th century, late 19th century, and really after Grant is out of the scene, because this doesn't really happen while Grant is around. But at a certain point, this nation puts reconciliation above all else in terms of priorities. Reconciling the North and the South, they put that above any sort of racial justice or protection for formerly enslaved people in the South. That's all sort of part of that election of 1876. But today we see that, we view that as very weird. Like, wait, he did this beautiful, wonderful Grant statue and also a Lee statue, but these were really, these men were seen as two sides of the same coin and very much equal parts by all the nation. And so I think in that time, it is totally uncontroversial, whereas today it would definitely be controversial.
Yeah, it's really, really fascinating. And I mean, if you want an illustration in contrast, if you look at the Robert E. Lee statue that he does in Charlottesville, it's very much, I think, what you would expect. You have this horse almost sort of bowing out of deference. You have this Southern gentleman, immaculate uniform, could not be more kind of the embodiment of the, what's the word I wanted to say? Like the noble, right? The noble cause of the Confederacy. And you compare that to Grant, who's, it's not triumphant, despite the fact that he is the triumphant party. It's not victorious, even though they're the victorious side. It is the war is hell version of this. And we just have to, there's no way, there's no other way but through it for this country. We have to fight this war and it has to win. The Union has to win. So even just artistically, to look at them side by side is so fascinating to me. And yeah, it's amazing that I think this is his work that will be the most debated, is the Lee statue, because of all the legal battle around it and the protest around it, but that by far the Grant Memorial is a much more compelling, much more interesting, and I think much more invigorating memorial. There's a lot I think you can take away from it historically and artistically. And I love that it brings the Civil War to life in a way that a lot of our Civil War statues do not. A lot of them at the end of the day are very static. They're very one note. They're really trying to do one thing. This shows the chaos. It shows the danger. It shows the excitement, but also the true stakes. I mean, in every part of that, whether it's the infantry, even the infantry kind of base reliefs, you see that there are young men who are going to die here. And I love it. It's so, so interesting and so complex.
Yeah. We did forget to mention one thing.
Oh, we did.
Edward Pierce Casey.
Oh, Edward Pierce Casey. So I'd like to bring this up. This is for our DC friends.
Yeah.
So technically, when Schrady does this design contest proposal, he is the sculptor and the artist, and he pairs with an architect, Edward Pierce Casey. Edward Pierce Casey does very little in terms of the design other than sort of the layout of the memorial itself, the balustrade, and the 8 lampposts, I think, are like his biggest contribution to the design. But Edward Pierce Casey is really interesting in Washington, D.C. He actually will take over the building of the Jefferson Building of the Library of Congress. So he takes over and oversees the last part of that beautiful Jefferson Building being completed. And he's responsible for my favorite bridge in Washington, D.C., and that is the Taft Bridge. Almost all of you listening to this, living, if you live in D.C., you know what bridge this is. You just don't know it's the Taft Bridge.
Right. I was going to say, now, do you love it because of the bridge, or do you love it for who it has since been memorialized to?
Both. I love it for both. Because it is a beautiful bridge. We're talking about the bridge that spans essentially over Rock Creek Park, connects DuPont Circle up to Woodley Park and Kalorama. So it's gorgeous for what it is, which is unreinforced concrete. And it's actually, I think, the largest unreinforced concrete bridge still standing in the world, or in the United States.
You don't really... Yes, yeah. In the world, I think, yeah. And you don't really realize how big it is, first of all, when you're crossing it, because you don't realize that Rock Creek Park just sort of like goes straight down from the road there. So you don't really notice how big and long it is until you're in Rock Creek Park, until you're underneath it. And then you look up.
It's huge.
It's massive. It is a massive, massive bridge.
And it's really lovely. Like the arches and everything, it's just beautiful to look at. And
fine details. Yeah.
And of course, it was named for a man who I love. of, and I mention often on this podcast, William Howard Taft. And the reason it's named the Taft Bridge is he walked it every single day. He walked from his home in like the DuPont Circle, Kalorama kind of area. He walked to the Supreme Court. And a lot of people, if they know about William Howard Taft, they know he was our heaviest president at one point, weighing in at about 320 pounds. But later in his life, when he's serving on the Supreme Court, he actually loses 100 pounds in his lifetime. And he commits to healthy habits, including walking to
work. That's great. Great. I don't think I knew that part. Yeah.
So that's why they called it the Taft Bridge, because he was so fond of, when the weather allowed, walking to the Supreme Court every day.
We are a walkable city.
But I also, I think it's just beautiful. It's it's the way it blends into the Rock Creek Park and sort of blends together the man-made and the natural. I think it's really lovely. And so Edward Pierce Casey is a man with a lot of good skill and ability, but he really is not intensely involved with the Grant Memorial. He sort of does his part, which is the layout and the and that element of it, the architectural elements, and then he kind of just lets Schrady go nuts.
Yeah,
literally.
he literally steps back and Schrady literally goes nuts. Yeah. Anything else?
I think that's it. We'll definitely, in the show notes, we're going to link to a few things to help give you a little visual for what we've been talking about. But if you're a local, you know, you're going outside anyway. It's one of the only things we can still do in the quarantine life. So take a stroll over to the Capitol and really take a look at this if you haven't, or if you've only ever whizzed by it, really set aside 10 or 15 minutes, because it's just incredible to look at. And when you really stop to look at it, you're going to want to spend more time than you've ever spent before with it. One of my favorites.
Yeah. I used to direct parents over to it as the kids were taking pictures. And then I stopped doing that because they would never get on the bus. They would start like wandering around it and looking at all these great details, which was awesome, but not when you have to keep to a schedule. But
I miss having such problems.
I know. I never thought I would say that I would miss school pictures in front of the Capitol, but I do. We do. Yeah.
Well, and this mini episode really just reiterates, we'll need to do a full episode and talk more about Grant in general, because I like the little Grant renaissance that's happening.
Yes.
And I think there's so much that people don't know and so much more we could appreciate about Grant and his life.
We need to wrap him all up, because you guys did a great job with the presidential drinking, which we just released a few weeks ago, I guess,
which is another example of sort of the Grant caricature that existed for so long, of this man who was just sort of this party animal or drank so much. And really, the drinking he did, a lot of it was depressive. It was, you know, I miss my family. I don't really want to be here fighting this war, but it's the job I have to do. And if I have to do it, I'll drink a little bit.
It's numbness in a bottle for him. It's self-medicating.
It's
not the sort of partying ways of Fierce Pierce or anyone else. So I think that wraps this up. Do you want to do our call outs?
I'll do it. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Tour Guide Tell All. If you're enjoying the podcast, be sure to like us and subscribe and review us on all of your favorite podcast listening apps. We love, love, love your reviews. It's great feedback for us. So please let us know what you think. You can also send us an email, tourguidetellall@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode or any episode you've listened to. And if you have a spot in DC that you're curious about, like what's that statue, what's that thing, email us and we will demystify it for you. And of course, a huge thank you to our patrons. Our patrons make this podcast possible. They literally put food on our table and keep us working while we're waiting for the tourism industry to come back. So our wonderful patrons are amazing, and you can be a patron too. For as little as a couple dollars a month, you can support the podcast, have access to special episodes and perks and all kinds of cool giveaways. And if you don't want to be a patron and just want to say thank you, you can always drop us a little tip at Venmo at Tour Guide Tell All. So lots and lots of ways that you can connect with us. Thank you for listening. Thanks for joining me, Dan. It's been a little while, so I loved having your beard here with me.
The listeners will just have to visualize it.
Just imagine a glorious ginger beard, and you have Dan.
Well, thank you, Becca, for this invitation. Again, one of my favorite memorials, and I know a lot of our favorite memorials, so I feel privileged to jump on this one. And again, as she just said, thank you so much to everyone out there that's supporting us. Every little dollar really, really helps us out and makes long nights of editing feel worth it. So thank you so much for coming out.
Bye.
Bye.
Tour Guide Tell All is brought to you by some of the fine guides at DC by Foot, one of the many cities covered by Free Tours by Foot. And as we start to reopen cities, we are giving private tours. Please check us out at freetoursbyfoot.com. Tour Guide Tell-All is Rebecca Grawl, Rebecca Fackner, Candon Arseniega, and me, Dan King.